first do is say, welcome. I'm Laura, and it has been so much fun this week having this three-part session with different people each time that has been so wonderful in terms of being here at Holden Village, the people that have come here and have been interested in how to engage and think about their own life of commitment and making positive social change. And what I found was that we were so luckily had different groups where people had such experience, and we very quickly had more of a facilitated dialogue discussion. So my hope is to continue with that today. But I do want to just give you the overview in terms of, for myself, I have been engaged for many decades in various forms of activism and education. And my concern has been in peace and justice. And more often than not, I've come up against these challenges. And so this discussion really grows out of my own interests and experiences and frustrations trying to undertake positive social change, learning from other people, and as an academic, studying this and now teaching. I teach at the University of Massachusetts Amherst undergraduates in international relations. So I want to be clear with you that I come at this from political science, kind of foreign policy, public policy perspective. And what's been great is in our discussions, we have people from a variety of backgrounds with experience, so I welcome that. But as I have thought about it, our first session was, and I found this so important in myself, and quite honestly, it's been a very discouraging time in terms of the things that I've committed my life to, in terms of my professional work, and even educationally, where I am just so hardcore with undergraduates that you need to be literate as citizens in this country, you need to know this information, and then having this pushback of, oh, that's just opinion, and a whole challenge in terms of what I hold very dear of the opportunities of an undergraduate education to actually read, critically reflect, and engage in a civil way. And it's not that it's a problem on my campus, but larger forces have come into play that have created a sense of siege. So this very busy slide kind of walks you through, as I was thinking about this three-part standalone lives of commitment, how do we make social change? The first session really focused on us as individuals here at Holden Community and exploring that spark of inspiration, those core values and beliefs that help to motivate us to think about problems and concerns in the world and how we want to challenge our energy. We really explored the role and value of networks. And this has been based on my own research and watching different movements and campaigns. They're the importance of working with others with shared aims and values, and critically, developing and reaching agreement on a plan of action in the real world. And I haven't had this problem here because, happily, this group, I think, has such experience. But with undergrads, that's a problem. Because they have grand ideas, they want to change the world, but then when it comes to plans of action, helping them to figure that out and follow through. We address the importance of community and stakeholders, and this idea that there's no such thing as this lone superhero. It really takes a village. And as I mentioned yesterday, exploring these kind of models of leadership where you address these key pieces of collaboration, how to handle controversy and differences, and then dealing with the group with civility and these differences. So that's what we did. This final session today is called Overcoming Adversity, The Impossible Will Take a While. And I'm gonna quickly just introduce myself. I'm Laura. I feel like this is kind of, and I am a recovering idealist because I have been quite depressed and overwhelmed over these last 2 years of many things that I did not expect, and many core issues and things that I just hold very dear and just assumed, okay, now we can move on, have kind of
crumbled.
So I'm quite clear. You can leave right now if you think you're getting answers, but that's sort of what motivates me. And looking at models of people that have overcome adversity, looking at past case studies and thinking how we move forward, appreciating that there's a lot to be learned from the past, but that we're facing very different circumstances today. And that's where my research has been, looking at this key thing of how ideas get on the agenda, how they turn into decisions, what are those opportunities, we call them windows of opportunity and turning points where you can have transformational debate, and that hand in hand with studying case studies of successful campaigns and social movements. So before we go on, I'm hoping each of you could introduce yourselves and just share why you're here today.
Well, Dick Nicene, I think the title of that book, it'll take a little while, is becoming increasingly true, and maybe I can get a kernel of hopefulness out of what seems like a depressing title.
Thanks. Chris, you get to another pass.
Another pass?
Yep.
Well, I'm here for the same reason. I'm a lifelong activist and participant in the political process. I've sort of been on both sides, in government, outside of government, beating on the doors of government, and in the streets. I've done all those things over the course of a 45-year career. And the last 2 years have been very hard. A lot of personal changes in my life, but also seeing much of the things that I worked on challenged, if not overturned. So that's been hard.
Michael Kupta. Well, I'm here today because I was here on Tuesday, but I guess I'm here partly because right now I'm the director of a nonprofit that does community organizing. And, you know, when this current political era started, there was a belief among many of us that we could still maintain civil discourse and common goals, etc., at a very basic neighborhood kind of level. Mm-hmm. And I've seen even that decay over the past couple of years. And so basically I'm just kind of looking to see what it is I'm missing, you know, if I find something that I may be missing, as to where are little tidbits that we can build, plant seeds on, to begin to reverse this, or at least freeze it in place for a while.
Mm. Excellent. Not excellent.
No.
Glad you're here.
I'm Catherine Coleman. First day here, obviously. There was a time when I was effectively an activist. Things seemed to get accomplished. An agenda could be set and you could work toward it. I responded to this topic because I don't see agendas getting set that we're able to work toward together. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very discouraging. Mm-hmm. Especially when the empire out there seems to have the agenda and all the power. I don't understand how we're going to work up against that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, so we have a common thread. Yeah.
That image you had of the drop of water.
Yeah.
And then rippled out.
Yeah.
Increasingly, it seems like a drop of water that has no ripple.
Right. Right. It just goes down. Yes. Yes. Defying. Yeah. Or it's a landing.
So how do you create a ripple?
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Well, so again, this is the topic for today: overcoming adversity, failures, inaction, things that we assume would move forward. And so this is not, and I apologize, I'm not a trained social worker or psychologist, but we're really looking at, there is a tremendous literature and a lot of shared knowledge of how you can cope with setbacks, and how what I have chosen to do is selectively look at key activists and key movements that have either adapted, reframed, have kind of been mothballed for a while, but then came back ultimately and have been able to adapt and successfully cope with changing circumstances. Okay, here is the secret thing. We are all, I think, and I've seen this over the last 2 weeks, there is an increasing climate of, you know, this apocalyptic feeling of, whether it be concerns about climate change, the rising sense of empires in decline, tensions on out, people are feeling fearful and concerned in a way that it's a psychological perception. And actually, one of the things when I talk to students, because I do stuff on national security, we go through this whole thing of, what does security mean to you? And the most fundamental thing, especially if you're talking about national security, these things, is to recognize that it's a psychological state. It's not some absolute. But there's no question, and especially for people, I think, that are here today, instead of being out hiking and going on off trail, that there is a sense of this fearful sense of, oh my gosh, we are at an alarming moment. And so on the one hand, you know, I have a quick fix. You know, all you need is your little survival kit. And this is, you know, one way of thinking about it. It's like, okay, and it's very appealing, the fear mongering. And, you know, there's sort of this whole way in which we've had these, we call them threat panics in American culture. And there, you know, it's, this is one of the things that you see in undergrads. You have all this discussion of zombies. Of course, that's not what I am offering. For me, that is sort of this funny way in which we kind of embrace this stuff. You see this survivalist and all these types of things. It is a very human feeling. I want to recognize that. But for me, what I have found is, and this is what I love about this book, this is a collection of essays, and I'm happy to just pass it along. But it's called Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. And it's wonderful. Various writers, poetry, issue areas that I find, and I'll just pass it around because I love it, but I use this with students to get people thinking. And I should mention that I have kind of worked on this stuff for a number of years in classes. So as we face this problem of overcoming adversity and coping with the reality of alarming setbacks, and you know, as you suggested, these things of just even civil discourse in our communities, things that weren't problematic are increasingly, how do you address it? I had used this earlier where I find it helpful, rather than thinking about how bad things are, it's trying to look at cases where, as much as possible, you see different individuals that have been able to sustain these efforts in the face of just tremendous setbacks, problems, and failures in a way that they were ultimately able to expand the possible. So it's looking for those opportunities. So that is something that I am not trying to sugarcoat. It is incredibly frustrating when you have worked, you know, as Chris and myself and other people that we know have worked for decades, you have laws that have been passed, it's codified, you think, okay, this is settled, now we can move on. They're getting pulled back it in with alarmingly precipitous ways and with enormous concerns. So I'm not saying that, but at the federal level, you have come up again and again against these roadblocks. So how do we cope? So just I want to start with, I'm going to quickly get into kind of my experience and sort of, I'm just culling away, just and at any moment, I'm hoping somebody will jump in and take over. I really see myself as a facilitator. So I just wanted to start with, you know, three lessons from the front lines that might be kind of something that would be useful for us to talk about. And this is the key piece that I have seen, especially with undergraduates, that they don't quite appreciate the fundamental importance and role of the policymaking process. And there's sort of, this goes hand in hand, that you have many of these issues are things that you can't just take care of yourself. That it does require engaging with government and key people that we call stakeholders in order for, whether it's laws, regulations, whatever. And the key piece is getting informed, who hold those levers, what is the information, who are your adversaries also in positions of powers, so that you are at least have a reality check on what you're up against. and you see the opportunities as well as obstacles. And this is the piece that if you talk to a long-term activist, anyone want to share stories where you've heard countless stories of this in terms of these different battles, kind of the more you learn. This is something that's fundamental as you're looking at larger issues of social change. The second piece, and I have this book that I love. This is a book by Tracy Kidder, Mountains Beyond Mountains, Paul Farmer. And what you see is that knowledge and persistence are needed to change various laws and policies. And the thing about Paul Farmer, he is somebody who is a tireless advocate for access to healthcare medicines. He has focused his life working both as a doctor in Boston, in communities in Boston that have been affected with tuberculosis, HIV, et cetera, but more importantly, set up clinics and a whole movement in Haiti to expand healthcare access. So it's a wonderful story. And in terms of his takeaway messages, what's really important to appreciate is this knowledge of, you know, he needed medicines. Who had them? How do you finagle it? It takes persistence. You have to be on the case. And he, in a core way, did not waver from his fundamental commitment that the expertise, the resources, all of that were going to be based clinics in Haiti, in this region. You needed to have the expert staff, all of it trained and supported locally. At the same time, in terms of getting the resources, he was in this total tension between Boston, wealthy donors, you know, grants, the naming and shaming in order to keep them alive over a lot of setbacks. And so that's where, in terms of the front lines of any number of movements, this idea of persistence and the need to change laws and policies is fundamental, I think, as you look at some of these larger changes and achievements. Third, in terms of lessons from the front lines, and we started to talk about this a bit yesterday, is that on a very personal level and in terms of organizations, you have this ebb and flow of the rise of this incredible mobilization, organized action, and you kind of have a rise and fall of we can change everything, we're going to make these changes, to a sense of cynicism, defeat, disillusionment, and burnout. And this is something that every social movement has had to confront, and the activists on the front lines have had to deal with this both themselves as well as with their organizations, and how you can tackle and address that issue of cynicism. What other words might people use for this? I was saying this feeling powerless in terms of trying to build and sustain your efforts in the face of other forces beyond your control, and the crucial importance of participation. So anyone want to comment, critique, or expand on any of these lessons?
I'm sitting here frustrated that with issues, whatever everybody's worked on in the last how many years, how is it that in Washington we can be doing, I'm going to say the Democrats, okay?
That's fine.
They could be working on the policy process. They're working through it. There are people of knowledge and persistence doing these things. They're tackling the minimizing of cynicism. But they can't make, there's no headway that we in the public learn about.
Yeah, right.
So what good is it to figure out what your own organization or agency or your interest group, full steam ahead, has meant?
What?
I mean,
I'm going to just do this.
The biggest thing I've learned is that it's not only know your adversary, it's know what you're opposing, or know the forces that are causing you pain. It's a little different than sort of saying in every immediate fight, you know who you're up against. You're up against, you know, if you're doing community organizing, you're up against a city council or a city manager or a housing authority, or you identify them. But they're just a teeny piece of this larger picture. And I've seen most movements fall apart when they gain some initial goals, they reach some initial objectives, and then it comes the next stage, you know, where, how do we move on to more extensive social change? And that's usually the point at which single-issue movements collapse, because they don't know, they really don't know who their opponent is. And, you know, when you wonder why the Democrats don't do more, and we think about wasted opportunities, I mean, Obama's election was the biggest political opportunity, you know, it seemed as though it was the biggest political opportunity of a generation. You know, black progressive president after a very reactionary Republican administration. People were primed, American people were primed for, you know, significant change, and then they didn't get it. You know, I mean, the Obama administration was filled with the holdovers from the Clinton administration, so corporate Democrats. And we got policies that were sort of warmed over Clintonism. With a very aggressive Republican opposition. Yeah. And so I think people just didn't understand that we have to win a battle within the Democratic Party or some other party. We have to win a battle where our leaders collectively have a progressive ideology and are advancing a progressive view. And we haven't won that battle yet. That's why we keep losing. I mean, we don't
have no agenda.
Progressives don't own the Democratic Party. We don't even own a third of it.
Yeah.
You know? And so that hard political battle facing the fact that you can win a particular vote or a single issue campaign now and again. But like Martin Luther King recognized, you know, he was somewhat naive when he first started out, you know, that he focused on civil rights. And then he realized after about 10 years that, you know, civil rights wasn't going to cut it for most of the things that he wanted to get accomplished. He had to deal with economic rights. And he had to deal with the war in Vietnam. And as soon as he did that, he lost all that centrist support. And his movement was disintegrating by the time he got shot. No, it was the civil rights movement was over.
So I can't resist jumping on, because in my personal history, as you said with the Obama election, for me, the high point, the highest hope was in 2009, his Prague speech that was moving a world free of nuclear weapons. And for the first time in U.S. history, you had leadership that was calling for an approach of nuclear disarmament that had never been voiced by a senior governmental official. And, you know, here he got the Nobel Peace Prize.
For just saying it.
And you had very organized actors that had been working for decades on this issue. And then it got on the agenda. This is like this, you know, this is where we talk about
for
this
a few weeks.
Moment of truth. Yes, this turning point. And so this is where again, you are absolutely right to highlight, and I'm going to go on. I'll go back and forth so that we don't jump forward with the discussion. But what you're talking about, for me personally, I ended up just writing a piece and presenting because it's just been so frustrating. What happened to this high point? And part of his speech was, "We harbor no illusions." And I use that in terms of the title of my piece of, like, here you have for the first time a president that put, you know, long term, not in our lifetimes, but we are going to explicitly move toward a world free of nuclear weapons. And then you look 8 years later at what ultimately unfolded, and
nothing like it.
It was, you know, on many, in terms of spending, modernization, all these areas. Yes, we had arms control agreements. Yes, there was a perception of better coordination and reduced threat in some ways. But in terms of the key pieces that you needed to really make it into meaningful change, it was not accomplished. So this is, again, you guys can shout me down, but for me, as I was looking, is sort of, why is it so difficult to understand, and especially with something like this that requires governmental action and coordination? And there is a lot of literature, and people that have worked as activists, I find it helpful for me, not just, we failed, or this person screwed up, or whatever, to gain insight. And John Kingdon had written from the 1970s on out of what he found was, and he was looking at health as a key issue of trying to address health reform, expanded healthcare access, and he was contrasting that with transportation, these two areas of government. And he did this study of kind of what gets on the agenda, what happens to these ideas. And he had these key insights that I think will resonate, where as you're looking at these problems, first of all, if you're trying to address social change in a fundamental way, you're trying to tackle things that are not really on the agenda and being adequately addressed. But what you find is very quickly, and what's I think I want to respect, and I love being here at Holden, in terms of you start with your local issues in a community, but very quickly you realize there's only so far you can go. You know, you have this remediation or different things like that. We can talk about it more or less, but that could not be handled here alone. That took actually trying to deal with the cleanup and governmental responses. So what you find is, as you study the way that our government has developed, he came up with these insights that, you know, why is it so hard to get things on the high-profile agenda, all these things we care about? Oftentimes, you don't see bills in Congress, you don't see budget lines, you don't see these things. And what he found was there are these three totally separate streams. And it's really interesting to see, as you're trying to study this, and this is, again, both understanding why it's so hard, the adversity, the setbacks, the problems, are very often you have a problem, and there are all these problems. And this is, again, when we were talking earlier this week, and people were identifying from sanctuaries, from Me Too, from all these things that are kind of drawing attention. There are these things that people are identifying as problems in our society, that is a stream. You have a constellation of issues that go, but that is separate. That is a separate stream than what you call the policy stream. And here you have, in the United States, long-standing entrenched institutions with key policies that have been, you know, every year going through, you have these cycles from budgetary, from required activities, from within the institutions, and that is quite separate. So you have different things going on that often activists have kind of come up hitting their heads against the wall, trying to kind of recognize that you have that. And then, of course, you have this third stream of politics. And that's what, again, you see with the upcoming election, what's in the news, what people are talking about, you know, build that wall, fights over the wall, etc., those types of issues. And as he was looking in a detailed case study, and I think we can explore this today, but I find it resonates as you're trying to think through these, why is it so hard? Why are these few moments? What you find is you have these ongoing streams, and it's not that you have to have all three come together at once, but it's actually harder, and there's so many obstacles of, you see this of, you know, people identify problems. We have, from the opioid epidemic, from various, I mean, well, you guys tell me problems that we've known about for decades and decades that are considered first priority in terms of what we see as problems in our society.
Healthcare.
Sure.
Opioids, healthcare.
Life expectancy. Infant mortality.
Any
the United problem? States ranks the low, you know, if you're talking about advanced democracies, we are in the lowest, and the disparities between different ethnic groups, different locations, city, in terms of infant mortality. It's shocking to see where the United States stands.
Unequal justice, unequal incarceration.
Incarceration, these different things, yes. So these are clear problems. They've been identified. Well, can you think of, I'm sure, what brought you, or what are problems that you...
Well, so many.
Yeah, so don't...
Homelessness,
yeah.
And
yeah.
The immigration refugees.
Yeah, yeah, so this
what
issue of homelessness.
Do?
Yeah.
What are we going to do?
Yeah, refugees, right, exactly. So you have this shocking number of problems, and yet they are not coming up and having, in terms of bills coming before Congress, resources, high level... focus of the executive.
So we are to understand that during the noise of all the politics,
yeah,
that's all the noise,
yeah,
that these other two streams that people are actively working
right.
in, these other
right.
two streams.
Right. So for me, I'm much more expert, you know, within the Defense Department, you have within these governmental institutions, these bureaucracies, if you think about it, you know, you see that there are ongoing policies. And so, for example, you know, if you're looking at our national security strategy, deployment of force, you have these doctrines, these are key policies, you have experts, it requires different types of analyses, updates. You check in with Congress, but you can't change these things. There's more continuity. And you see certain pieces, but you need to recognize that as you're going up. And so this is what's interesting, for example. Does anyone want to give an example of a policy that you see that you've had to butt with? I know that you've had this happen again and again in terms of different policies in your work.
Well, I mean, a major obstacle that's been present for 60 years is this something called the doctrine of deterrence of nuclear, that we need nuclear weapons to ensure our national security, and we need to threaten other countries with them, actively threaten
them. Very
in order to keep ourselves secure, and it becomes so embedded in the system, and so many people profit from that notion. You know, all the defense contractors and all the government agencies that, you know, take care of nuclear weapons and build nuclear weapons and design them, they all, of course, say this is the way to defend the country because that's how they earn their keep. And so just to change that means overturning a way of life, really, that's deeply embedded in our society, involving the jobs of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. So you can understand it's just very, very hard when you just think of, well, why don't we just adopt a different idea? But it's not just an idea, you know. You know, why can't Congress be more receptive to, you know, the church's notion of peace? And the answer is that they don't. Their constituents, by and large, an important, you know, there's a hierarchy of constituents, as you and me. And then there's the corporation that's building the missile, you know, in the congressional district. And those people rank a lot higher than us. And so in order to change things like that, we need massive mobilizations.
And it just occurs,
you know, you're not going to do it. We did have an effect on the doctrine of deterrence in the 80s when Reagan came in. Because Reagan scared enough of the public, people were sufficiently alarmed that we were able to enlist the support of millions of people. And so then we took key votes on specific parts of our overall proposal to end the arms race. And we won those votes. But that was a very, very rare experience, that popular mobilization trying to control the defense budget. It's the first time that actually happened in American history. And so, you know, it's and then it faded. We only had about 5 or 7 good years, and then the public lost interest, and, you know, other things happened, and the movement fell apart. But, you know, for me, it was an example of what it does take to make a major change in policy. It's really hard, and although there are other things where smaller things where if you get all these things to line up,
yeah,
the way Obama did, you know, there was that 6 months, 12 months really, in his first year. People have been working on healthcare reform for decades. My boss, Ted Kennedy, you know, had been working on a single payer healthcare bill for decades. Didn't get anywhere. And then suddenly we had this moment where the public concern about health insurance was peaking. And the healthcare, and there was a number of bills, and we had a new president with some political momentum, and it got done. You know, the ACA got done, but it was a flawed bill, but a lifesaver for millions of people.
And you see, in contrast, during the Clinton administration, this had been the highest priority early on, and it failed.
But
so
it wasn't a big mobilization. So
right.
It was like this policy window. So sort of things came together, and there was a group of people who were prepared to act very quickly to get it done. So that can happen on something that's important. But, I mean, I think on sort of major changes in the character of our country and in the character of our public life, those are extremely rare opportunities. I mean, I think that this next presidential election is such an opportunity, but it's not, you know, if we just sort of sit back and think, and let the establishment Democrats nominate Joe Biden. You know, then we'll.
Or Amy Klobuchar.
Right.
Or Amy Klobuchar or any of the moderates. Yeah. I mean, they're so ready to just go back to the status quo. And I worry that we don't have the depth of public mobilization that we need. Trump has his 46% who are pretty fanatical and wildly racist and antagonistic, and our coalition is quite disparate. You know?
Well, do you think popular mobilization, if you get it on whatever issue, let's say the next candidate, where do you put in that list, that stream, the lobbyists?
Okay, we're getting to this.
Can the lobbyists take control of this popular mobilization that you say you need to get one thing?
Take control.
Well, the
legislators come back home and they tell
us. You know the answer to your question. Yeah. Republicans have fought election finance reform for 30 years. As long as I've been in Washington, the Republicans have been opposing election finance reform. And enough Democrats joined them so that even when we had a Democratic majority in both houses, we couldn't get meaningful finance reform through.
And then the Supreme Court invalidated.
So I wanted to show just a couple steps, because like, you guys are onto such key things. If we want to get into more detail on the problem scene, but then what you're asking is, like, who are these key actors? And you identified, we call them in political science policy entrepreneurs, but lobbyists indeed. And, you know, how do we understand this? And this is, again, having a key critical understanding of the role and importance that they play. And, again, you can identify what, and this is really what's important as you're really trying to grapple with this in a substantive way, and it's kind of know what you're up against, know who you can work with, both on your own side and in terms of other things. I mean, what are they motivated? These are policy entrepreneurs. Our system sets it up this way in a democracy. It's designed to have this type of lobbying. All of us lobby for the things we care about. So what are they motivated by? So anyone want to build upon any of these?
Well, I mean, the lobbying establishment as we currently know it really got going in the Reagan administration. Before that, believe it or not, most major companies didn't have full-time lobbyists. The corporate presence in Washington was not nearly what it is today. And it's part and parcel of all the changes that were ushered in by Reaganism and that have continued. And I don't know, when you have someone who's donating to a politician's campaign and whining and dining them and is supported, is earning $1,000 an hour, and has an army of people to help them write legislation, has all the details. They walk in to a member's office with fully worked out bills.
Yeah, this is what's
in their interests.
Yeah.
And, there's a little bit that we can, the union AFL-CIO can do that on the other side, but it doesn't have the resources, that all these other companies do, and particularly the financial resources to finance these guys' campaigns. And so the whole thing is tilted from the get-go.
Yes.
That you wonder, why hasn't the Democratic Party made finance reform the be-all and end-all of their basic approach to politics?
Well, that's the key.
Because it's really hard to see, it's not impossible, but it's really hard to see how we were going to get very much change given that situation.
Given
the stranglehold that companies have on the Congress. I mean, we live with a lot of illusions about democracy and how, just if citizens mobilize, they'll prevail. But, it's harder to believe that now.
I want to jump in, though, because I want to take you on, because there's a website called The Hill, and it's Capitol Hill, and it used to be an Inside the Beltway thing. It's now become a news publication. But what I love about it is they say the top 10, top 100 most influential lobbyists of the year, every year they give awards. So it's not just money. It's this question of who are the most influential, and they name names of these key lobbyists. And I really encourage you to go look at it, because what's really striking, they have been doing it every year. But it's not just, defense contractors or, you know, key energy interests. It's also, as you said, the labor union, teachers union, 350.org. They break it down into different nonprofits, corporate entities, states are quite important in terms of lobbying for their interests. And so it's a really fascinating piece. But what's really notable is I've tracked this forever. And again, it's who are the organized interests in our society. You think, oh, it's the Sierra Club, it's this and that.
Realtors.
Right, realtors. Now, though, if you look at the most influential ones, it's big pharma, it's hospitals, it's the health insurance industries, and Amazon, the kind of big high-tech, Facebook, the Silicon Valley, in terms of the most influential. So it's very interesting as you're trying to kind of get a sense of this. And so I'll just jump ahead in terms of who are these actors and understanding we all kind of think we know there are visible actors. You know, I think we've been at this long enough. Those are the people. You also have any number of special interests. We've sort of seen that. But what's increasingly a challenge are a number of these invisible actors. And as you know, Chris and we all are aware of this dark money that's coming in that are able to block consideration of proposals that they do not prefer. And this is a key piece of understanding that policy stream, these different stages. And my husband said, don't you dare show this to these people. But if you really care why it's so hard, this is a regulatory map of all the different steps involved in rulemaking. And at every step of the way, there are opportunities to block, delay, to change, to weaken, to co-opt, to tweak. But it's very important. It's not just like, I have a good idea, we're going to do it. Very, very rarely does that happen. We have a system, it's not direct democracy. We have a system that's designed. It's slow, it takes a long time. And this is the key piece I try to both, not to discourage people, but to get literate and savvy about where this is.
Well, this is actually, it's, you know, it depends
on
which role.
You don't have to be tortured,
which,
but yeah, I care about this.
It depends which role you're in. If you're proposing a rule, let's say you pass legislation, and now you have to get the federal agencies to implement it, you have to go through a rulemaking process. It takes a long time. If you're proposing a rule, this is a very onerous process. If you're
opposing
something, now that Trump is the one who's trying to get rid of rules, this actually works in our favor. It's a lengthy, elaborate process because he's doing things by executive fiat and he's not following the law. And so it's easy to challenge most of the things
down.
He's doing by saying you didn't follow all the steps in rulemaking.
Yeah.
Yes,
so
but with Obama, it seemed, where were the steps? All the Republicans had to do was vote no.
Well, again, this
they
is
weren't
the...
following a bunch of steps.
Right.
They just
but
said no, no,
that's
no.
That's because
exactly.
the actual legislation that would have enabled the rulemakings didn't get passed. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's the problem.
But again, what's very important is in with different issue areas and different interests and things, it played out different ways. So again, the key piece is if it's a matter of national security, threat to the country, the executive has... You know, there's been expanded power to operate outside of the rules. Other areas in civilian life, you know, it's much more likely that you have to come up against this process. So it's important to kind of distinguish that. But just so, again, this is where we now have these invisible actors. You know, they'll initiate considerations, set agendas on their own. And what's interesting is when these organized interests come into conflict, you have these other, and as it plays out with the national, with these different policy streams, you have a combination of the national mood, elected politicians, that this combination is likely to prevail. So it's sort of trying to understand and untangle and sort of get a sense of these different forces, at least as far as setting an agenda. So this is something that I think is helpful as we're trying to understand and tackle this problem of the setbacks, the adversity, the frustrations.
I mean, the same structure exists in each state capital. It's on a smaller scale, of course, but states have regulations, states have enabling legislation, states have lobbies. You know, the farmers and the lawyers and the doctors are all lobbying their state legislature when legislation comes up that affects their interests. So you can kind of get your feet wet. You know, at the state level, you don't have to go to Washington to launch a campaign and do things. And I think we've seen it, the way California has kind of gone its own way.
Yes.
Independent of the Trump administration, and in fact, the Trump administration's actions have been a goad for California to pass progressive legislation. So it's actually almost been enabling from that point of view. And that's been encouraging in the sense that maybe we don't have to act necessarily on the federal level. There's a lot of things that we can do, you know, on a municipal or a state level.
Well, Richard, you wanted to go.
Yeah. So.
Well, I kind of would. The invisible actors, what kind of struck me, I'm going to just crystallize it with two books I read. One was Democracy in Chains. Mm. And I was like, oh my crap, all these slogans I hear now have a 40-year history. And it just, you can trace the pedigree back almost to the day Social Security was passed, but maybe you know, at least John Birch Society and beyond, and James Buchanan and all that stuff. One side, and then I read Thomas Frank's Listen, Liberal, and he talks about all the buddies that Obama had, all on Annisport, vacationing, all the Wall Street.
Martha's Vineyard.
Martha's Vineyard. So, and they're rubbing shoulders with each other. Yeah. And I think that. So Tim Gaither, just his whole mindset is just a little left of center from all this crap coming from the other side. So it sits there. There's black, but slightly left. And then the other one's got this all the way to the far right. But it's just like,
well,
wow.
Both of
those books were indicting and didn't give you this knight in white armor solution to anything.
Well, there are two things I just want to say. I want to identify as an educator that it's important to recognize this is by design. If you look at the way that our system of government was set up, you know, the system of a lot of power at the state level, and, you know, in terms of this, the continuities, this is sort of by design in terms of why the status quo and why our democracy, actually, compared to other countries, is it's both different than other democracies, but this idea of kind of limiting action and change and input, that you have sort of more continuity than
well,
you
the
have.
Fear, the fear of the masses.
Right. There's
the
no
Washington,
sense that they're very clearly
Jefferson,
it's not
all
a
good thing. Feared the masses.
Yeah. Do you want to, wait,
So Christopher makes some points about effectiveness at the state and local level that I think we should talk about. Because I know your work is focused, and so far we've been talking a lot on the national level. And Catherine raised a point about an agenda, and I think it goes beyond an agenda. I think, I mean, we know on the right, the Heritage Foundation, for example, back to the days of Lewis Powell, establishing this whole set of visions for corporate America. And so that's been played out. They have a playbook. They use it when the opportunity comes along. And disparate on the left or the center, or whatever you want to call it, there's very few things that we could consistently say, this is what we're pursuing. And that is part of the problem, I think. It's not so much an agenda, but what are the values that we're pursuing in society? And if we don't have those defined values, we don't have the ability to have the long term, to go beyond single issue campaigns into structural change. And you know, I think as depressed as we often are under the Trump administration, I mean, one thing we are seeing, and you mentioned California, but we're seeing there's been a lot of success, quote unquote, from the left in social issues. There hasn't been necessarily that kind of change at the national level.
No, it's really exciting.
And there also has not, in my opinion, been from the left, the center, whatever you want to call it, the ability to take the big picture approach in that all these things are distractions. I mean, the real challenge of this society is one of the real challenges, but they're all intertwined, is the continuing and growing income inequality.
Oh, you got my next slide.
It affects so many of these problems or issues or whatever. And, you know, some would argue that you know, racism is the core cancer of our society, and I'm not going to disagree with that, but I see kind of the class warfare and racism as different sides of the same coin that are used in tandem to prevent you know, the average person from experiencing the promise of this country.
Right. So that's kind of highlighting, do you agree that kind of falls in that politics stream of what you're saying, of what's everyone's talking about, what's the politics of these issues, is not addressing what you're identifying as a core...
Correct. And, you know, and what I find perhaps hopeful in the... I've been gone for a week, so how many Democratic candidates are left, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, the 10 or whatever that one...
I'm waiting till after Labor Day to pay attention.
That there's been a lot of ideas thrown out there that never get into the mainstream discussion, but yet they happen at the local level, they happen at the state level, and we from the left or the social justice community or whatever, you know, have seen progress. We've seen progress on gay rights. We've seen a lot of progress on racial issues in this country. We just have not dismantled all the structural supports for racism. And so you can... Living wages, the whole concept of a living wage is being driven completely by people with a vision. It was seen as... When people said 15 now, everybody laughed.
Yeah.
And now it has become the norm because people had a vision. They knew who they were trying to help, what the target was, what the goal was, and partly as a combination of the way the economy has gone, it became achievable, realistic.
Yeah.
And so those are the kind of things we have to recognize.
It's the perfect goal for achieving piecemeal, because any political entity from a city to a state, you know, can pursue that.
But
right?
I would
have the right of the Constitution to do it.
I would also argue it's, you know, in some ways our equivalent of, you know, the American Medical Association uses, you know, say Medicare was the camel's nose under the tent for socialized medicine or whatever, right? And this is it. If we can get society and people to go along and recognize that helping raise the wages of people at the bottom of our economic strata creates a lot of spillover good, we can begin to address what to me is one of the major issues. But that's the other part. We also have, if you believe public opinion polls, the American public is a lot more, I'll call it justice-oriented, than government policy. And on so many areas, whether it's gun control, wages, equal pay for women, on and on and on, public opinion is in support of these. And there's... So this entire institution of actors that you've identified, their real goal is to disconnect policy from public opinion.
Right.
That's
right. So that's why...
That is what they specialize in doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So thank you, because you are so on the mark in terms of at the local level, there's this rise of activism, there's all these issue areas that you've talked about. And we use... Zinn earlier of like all these small pieces of many people, many cities, those opportunities, and again, distinguishing with, you know, sort of these actions, policies, and...
think of the ways that ordinary people have been disconnected from politics, from gerrymandering districts, having to work two or three jobs. How much time do you have for politics or even self-education if you're working two or three jobs?
And having an ID. Eating an IV, test, and North Dakota.
That's a key point, the disconnecting of a large percentage of the population from participation in the political process is how we got into this mess, I think.
Yeah.
It's just occurred gradually over several decades. But
And I forget, there have been numerous books written, and so I'm not taking credit for this at all, but, you know, the change in our society, post-World War II, people joined groups and they were... fraternal organizations, I know that's a gender-specific term, but fraternal organizations, and people participated. And now, I mean, you mentioned things like the Sierra Club, for example, the National Resource Defense Council the other day. People support those with their checkbooks.
Right.
They're not members in the way they were members of the lodge in their community, for example, or even the labor unions. I mean, it's become in many ways a financial membership rather than a personal membership.
So we get into that in different types of engagement. Yes,
One way to formulate it, at least it runs in my head, was so radically individualist, and I think sometimes liberals pursue, you know, all kinds of individual rights. And from that position, it's very hard to oppose libertarianism. You could crisscross in the rhetoric right away. And what we need here, what you're talking about, is communal values.
Right.
And the communal, a sense of the common good, but in a highly individualized arena or personal philosophy kind of thing, compounded by the market individualizing us, marketing to every single taste. I was on a faculty, we used to bemoan the lack of communal values and so on. And you had to take a look in the mirror. The faculty were in exhibit A of the very individualism they were hollering about. Because I can teach what I want, I have tenure, blah, blah, blah. We can't do assessment, we can't have all kinds of behavior that was exhibit A of what they were arguing against.
So I don't want to
say. And I wasn't free of contamination and participation in that.
This is excellent. I just want to respect, because this is a 2-hour session, I just had the set so that if anyone feels like they want to take a break, move around, go to the bathroom, we're officially giving you a chance to take a break if you would like. I want to respect your time and interests, but that's why I just had that alarm. But should I stop and encourage people, or are people good to keep going? Anyone can leave at any time, or anyway. Okay, great.
I think what we lack. I mean, I think Elizabeth Warren is gradually moving towards this by just sort of accreting specific policy proposals in a number of areas, and it's starting to add up into fairly impressive reform agenda. But that's what we lack. We lack a common reform agenda that goes to sort of the basic things, like you mentioned the way the rules, Justice Powell's agenda and how it's been implemented, how corporations have gained much more leverage over our lives than they ever had before through changes in law and changes in court decisions, court precedent. And so we have to undo it. We have to undo all that. We have to get into the weeds and have a detailed, reform agenda having to do with labor rights, diminishing corporate rights, usury laws. I mean, I can't believe that the banks borrow at 1% from the Federal Reserve and loan it out to us at 18.5% on our credit cards. I mean, that used to be called usury, but now it's called business.
Yeah. And again, what I love about being here in Holden Village is that you have a community which has been quite successful and been able to sustain on a very different, just from food use, energy use, all these different values that are suggesting that there are different ways of organizing.
This has been my own thinking, an influential experience, because I'm thinking this place is so well run, it runs so smoothly, and it's sort of, I would call it sort of semi-communal. It's not sort of like a kibbutz in Israel, but it's pretty communal, but it's also voluntary and reasonably priced. And I'm thinking, why don't we organize the rest of our lives like this? I mean, why do we all, live in little houses and cook for ourselves and clean for ourselves and mow our own lawns and so forth? When you think about it, it's just, this is a very sensible way to live.
Because
so I'll just tell you.
We won't give up the individuals.
Yes.
In order to create
Let's
this common...
Let's start with your town hall.
This common good.
So when I start with the American creed, going
but
back
maybe
from
just
the
just changes in our laws that facilitate places like Holden Village, where it would be easier to form something like this and get it incorporated and get it inspected. And, co-ops notoriously have problems with health, the health inspectors. They come in and look at the communal kitchen, and it doesn't meet the restaurant standard, and they shut them down.
Right.
That kind of thing. So, there's a whole host of things, but it just being here reminds me, there is we don't have to live the way we do. We could live in more intentional communities and thereby take care of, you know, the elderly and the young. Those kinds of communal living situations would, just by their very nature, provide care for children and care for the elderly. And so, yeah, I mean,
this is all very interesting because I now feel I come from the Midwest, and I really feel it right now in this discussion because I'm in a very liberal community in Northfield, and we can't raise an argument about much. But we are critical of the individualism of the progressives on all these individual issues and keep demanding that we in the Midwest are too, like Amy Klobuchar, or too middle of the road, and you know. But somebody who's, so that's when I said in the very beginning, the candidates represent the inability to come to an agenda that might represent the common good of defeating Trump. And so we don't feel as if somebody, Elizabeth Warren, great as she is, and all these ideas, our middle of the road
right.
feeling isn't that that can happen.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that is the thing. It's defining a set of meaningful reforms, what people used to call non-reformist reforms, reforms that actually lead from where we are to some better society, and having that agenda commonly understood and accepted by a wide number of people.
Well,
that's kind of like the task.
We're not anywhere.
No, we're not. Yeah. But that's kind of my own mind. That's where I think that when we have that, that's when we'll start getting somewhere.
Right. So in Minnesota, the reform group, I mean medical reform people, they have just dug in and have been working for years. And their leadership now says to us in Minnesota, we have to do this by state. We ought to put the reform into place here in Minnesota.
Yeah,
as it's done on the West Coast, by
or in Massachusetts.
Well, I feel like that's probably what informs your professional
yes.
choice of starting at the local
and
level.
Others
want to
imitate
it.
Well,
yeah.
See what can be done.
I mean, you know, of course, then you're too successful at the local level, and then they start doing state preemption.
Yeah.
You can't pass this kind of policy
right.
at the local level because it creates too many different. Rules for businesses.
You're too far ahead of the
I'm all for states' rights except when I'm not.
Yeah. So it's like, well, fine, then take it up at the state.
Right.
But
right.
they don't.
Yeah.
It's simply
yeah, yeah.
a way of vetoing you know, what's actually more genuine democracy. I mean,
right.
You know, we don't have democracy here except in very rare circumstances, but the local level is far closer to genuine democracy than state level. And
yeah.
the state level is far more closer than federal level, et cetera.
Right.
You know, that's one of the things we have to be, you talked about who, not knowing who necessarily who our adversaries are, but what are the forces that are opposing us? And that's one of them, that if, you know, if we're too successful, then they want to steal the ability to make that decision.
Well, yeah, we have that, yeah, the parochialism, and also, you know, your rivals, your nearby rivals up and down, you know, either geographically or... issue areas. You
an earlier
that, yeah.
slide you had triggered for
oh,
me.
Should I go back?
Well, no.
Okay.
I was wondering as an example, trying to figure out the contrast between hospice nursing, which I think is pretty embedded, and it's quite different than dying in an institution. That's pretty deeply embedded, I think, in the kind of medical, how we think about that. And then you think about home health care, how beset that is by exploiting low labor, all kinds of charlatans in the business that I don't censor in the hospice movement. So now I've got two healthcare things here that at least look to me like from family experiences to go in very different directions, both of which appear to be, you know, something other than the conglomerate hospitals and all of that. But they just have gone in different pathways, at least in my family experience, in different states too.
And that's what I wanted to highlight, because coming from Massachusetts, I teach at a university, and I'm now doing a course that has all the majors are from the sciences and going into healthcare industry. So a lot of them did their honors theses looking at, as you were suggesting, sort of from retirement homes, access to healthcare. And we were naively shocked, it's not my area, to see the way Massachusetts is regulated for retirement homes, hospice, all those things, in contrast to, with deregulation at the federal level, the enormous explosion expansion of privately owned and run retirement homes, hospice, and especially in this area of home health care workers.
Yeah,
and it's very dramatic. The public is not aware of it. The disparities and differences, as you said, in different states and different regions has had a tremendous impact in terms of what's, rather than, you know, do no harm or the healing profession and maximizing profits. And that's really one of those things that have not, but people have experienced it in a firsthand way with a loved one, but they haven't put it together. And this is where it was very exciting to see promising young students who are going into this area.
Yeah, that's where the crisis is going to come down the road because of the aging of our nation.
Yes.
That is going to be a huge health crisis.
Yes. Yes.
So will be also a labor crisis.
Yes, yes. So here we go. Okay, so this is an interesting question and problem because very often, you know, you've had these trends in the healthcare field in contrast to in transportation. You can have an airplane disaster, you know, as terrible as it was, a plane crashes or you have a rail crash or some catastrophic event and it serves as a focusing event, draws attention. The question is, sometimes this is temporary, as unfortunately with certain nuclear accidents and different things, about whether or not you will have a fundamental change. Others, it leads to and serves as a turning point in terms of changing outcomes. The field of healthcare is quite different in terms of this whole, the whole other dynamics as you're trying to identify it. Can you think of any, and for myself in my work, what I see the most often, you see this, is either a flu outbreak, pandemics, you have those types of things that can serve as potentially catastrophic focusing events, but otherwise you don't have those same type of high visibility actions that if you're looking at when something gets on the agenda and you're able to overcome all these organized interests and all the stars line up that you actually get a policy outcome that is fundamental change, such as the Affordable Care Act or whatever, is much more rare in that field in contrast to others. So people that really study this stuff, and again, it's important to understand this because as good and as wonderful as people working for social change, it's very rare when the stars line up and you have these outside focusing events. People are working tirelessly. And the first day I identified, you know, from Nelson Mandela, any number of movements where for many, many decades, and Zinn talks about this, all these people have been acting for many years, and you never know when you're going to have that big breakthrough or opportunity. And this is something, though, that, again, hand in hand with the policy entrepreneurs and these people, these different actors that have a role, what you see is every once in a while, you have these moments. It can be some type of a powerful symbol. This came up earlier in the week when we were talking about the father with his dead child that just riveted the world in terms of issues of the refugee catastrophic impacts, any number of other symbols. It served as a focusing event for the public. There are any number of these. The question is whether or not it'll only have short-term transient effects, it'll fall off the agenda, it won't get resolved, or whether or not you will actually get a turning point and a change. And so this is kind of the key piece for me that I have been preoccupied and obsessed with as you look from, you know, as I was interested in these key issues and values of concerns. What are these problems? How do we identify them? How do we come and take actions, get it on the governmental agenda? And then what are these moments when you have fundamental decisions with outcomes? And on the one hand, I'm just going to take one silly, not silly, formative example in my life was the Berlin Wall is an example that was one of the most monumental changes of the 20th century. People had been working on these issues for decades. Nobody knew it was really coming. It was something that was formative in our lives. And what you found with a relatively short amount of time, very little bloodshed compared to what might have been possible, you had the end of this Cold War standoff opening up over time. So you have on the one hand that, and as you study this, and for me, I just want to highlight, here we have the wall in Israel, the West Bank, this wall, and people have been working for decades and decades trying to tackle this problem. And yet, we still to this day have ongoing concerns. It's even further. In fact, as you know, if you
further from a settlement.
Further from a settlement. We've gone further backwards. So what are the forces? There have been wars, there have been conflicts, there have been any number of possible turning points or focusing events in that arena, yet you aren't able to move forward in a way that I think people would agree is kind of positive social change for security. And we are now trying to kind of tackle this currently in our debate over the wall along our border, yet again. So I'm throwing this back at you all. How do you make sense of this as you think about you have this challenge of overcoming adversity, and yet, for me, you never know which way it will go. But what do you all think?
Well, I can say on the national level, I think that this actually, Trump, as bad as Trump has been, of course, it's because he's been so bad that we've seen the Democratic agenda expand to include things they never would have dreamed of talking about, like Medicare for all, health care for immigrants, you know, I mean, an amazing array, a Green New Deal. You know, we're now having policy debates that were impossible to have within the Democratic Party 5 years ago. So in that sense, you have to view the extremism of the Trump presidency as opening one of these political opportunities.
Yeah.
Certainly it's opened it at the local level. You know, when we had that, when the Nazis attacked Charlottesville, and I nearly lost both my daughters on that day, it transformed the town. You know, we elected a black female mayor for the first time in the history of the city, a poor black female mayor. And it, so these moments just happen. She's absolutely right. They, you know, Reagan's election, the disarmament movement in the United States was absolutely struggling. It was still alive, but it was struggling. And then Reagan was elected, and it just opened a window. Suddenly people were willing to listen to a message they hadn't been willing to listen to
for
decades.
Maybe they are policy change windows.
Yes.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. No, I mean,
and historically.
Political. And then the question is, how prepared are you to take advantage? You know, are we going to, you know, are the Democrats and progressives going to rise to the challenge and somehow coalesce in a way that we can present an agenda to the American people that is appealing enough that they will vote with us rather than with Trump?
Yes. Well, but meanwhile, with a one-day decision, Trump takes $2 billion from the defense budget, says he's going to build the wall.
Yeah, he's invoking some legal authority that's going to get adjudicated in the Supreme Court as to whether he can actually do it.
So, again, if you go back in American history, there's a whole literature on, it's called realignments, and you have this pendulum of different progressive eras. And so going back from the Gilded Age to the 30s, a progressive era, you have these periods where you have these kind of extreme abuses, big disparities, either wealth or, you know, all these different social issues, work issues, racial divides, and yet you do have these shifts. So the interesting question is, sometimes there is this kind of transformative push and then you move on. But I just am jumping ahead because I wanted, in the past people have really been concerned about this fundamental challenge of human rights with immigrants, with undocumented, with cages, what's going on with this administration, and what you're hearkening to me, and it's again my job as kind of an academic, we call these enduring debates. And right now we're at a moment of, are things being stretched? And then, or is it going to break? And there's a pendulum if you're looking at the United States government. And at some times, you know, it's sort of a fundamental question. And of course, we don't know. I'm not pretending I know. But, you know, it's sort of going back, looking back historically, it can kind of help you. And I think right now, as we try to think about it, and again, this is my goal is we're finding glimmers of hope and opportunity and sort of a sense of resilience as we struggle with these forces. Some, it's extraordinary, the things that have changed with people's work. And, you know, we've just suggested some of them, but there are just so many in my lifetime that I never would have expected. And then others, I thought, oh, I thought this was settled. And now it's under threat. So
I mean, I certainly wonder, the Trump administration has really, you know, you have to ask yourself, is he a symptom or is he a cause?
Yeah.
Was he elected because he's a manifestation of what we really are like as a society? And I'm increasingly of that view that he was elected because he spoke for a significant fraction, I don't think a majority, but a significant fraction of Americans who are
voters. I want to be very important in terms of, we political scientists, we want to be precise in our terms.
Voters,
what's your
absolutely
sample?
Voters, and electoral voters.
Yes, electoral voters, right. Yeah.
But I mean, because he didn't win the popular vote, which is a very encouraging thing. But nonetheless, we saw an underbelly of our society, which has been there all along. I mean, and in fact, we are increasingly uncovering our real history. You know, everything from the 55 or 5700 lynchings that are now being memorialized in this museum, Birmingham, by the Justice Project. And we had one in Charlottesville that from the not too distant past, and so people took some dirt down there, and there's now a cross or an obelisk form. We're recovering our history. I think what we were taught, what the ideas that the average American walks around in their head about what America is and how it was built, most of it's fiction, it's fantasy. They have no clue, And so we're contending with that with a huge level of public ignorance that's been deliberately fostered, I believe. The attacks on public education are to sort of disempower the next generation, so that the corporations and their allies will have even more power over us, because people won't even have a sense of their own past.
Is it fair also to add a second item, is that not paralyzing self-introspection, but at least some of it, to say, okay, the charge of elitism, what did I do to contribute to that?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a PhD.
Yeah.
How do I engender resentment? That some of it's inevitable, okay, it's class warfare, blah, blah, blah. But also, how did I exacerbate that? Not to paralyze, but that's a cause that I think I need to tend to on my side, too, because I'm not innocent. My theological anthropology doesn't allow me to claim innocence.
So can I just jump in? I'm sorry. I want to make a pitch, because I included on the reading list by Arlie Hochschild. It's called Strangers in Their Own Land.
Yes.
And it's very powerful. And I just wanted to highlight, I'm trying to grapple with this myself.
Cross that, right?
And what,
she listened across her reception of elitists.
Right.
You're from Berkeley, good God, what are you doing here? And among her own students, even.
Yeah.
She bridged that gap. That was a huge investment of her.
Yeah.
Was 8 or 13 trips.
And it started out, what was fascinating, so if you're not familiar with this book, have you ever heard of this book, Strangers in Their Own Land? It's a detailed study of Louisiana, trying to understand, and she initially was interested, and she's a sociologist, and she was looking at the rise of the Tea Party movement, and so she started doing all these interviews with individuals to try to understand, because that was one of the locus, and trying to understand what were the issues in success. It very quickly morphed into a study of this feeling of loss, abandonment, and a sense of discrimination in communities in Louisiana. Initially, she was fascinated on environmental issues, this increasing distrust of the government, skepticism, and this feeling that they have been left behind, this sense of legitimate grievance on the part of people in rural communities that, on the one hand, had been the most affected by corporate contamination, corruption.
How deluded do you have to be to view Trump as your savior?
So this is what she does a good job, though, of identifying in terms of understanding these areas. There is a sense that there was a feeling, a perception among working class individuals that their communities, this issue of arrogance and elitism and a cynicism and distrust of government. And at the same time, if you looked at it, these communities actually have the highest in terms of handouts of Social Security welfare checks in terms of the net, how much federal money is going into those communities compared to what they're paying in taxes is actually amongst, it's
yeah, they're dependent.
So again, she grapples, but what's wonderful about it is, well, please, if you've read it, somebody else share. But I use it for my students in Massachusetts because they have no clue.
How does she deal with the problem of false consciousness? That these people are supporting policies that make their lives worse.
Again, she saw her task is trying to understand how is it that this community is feeling like this idea of strangers in their own land, that the government is no longer representing them, that they have been left behind, that there is, and very importantly, this... Okay, so how...
So the question could... One way, she doesn't ask this directly, but the question could be, if you're a member of the social welfare state level or federal, or of the EPA, how did you lose them?
Right.
When you were advocating for
right.
them.
Right.
How did you end up losing them?
Right.
Now, partly you can blame the rhetoric co-option by the oil interest and all that, but you lost them
yes.
somehow.
Yes.
You lost
right.
your...
And she uses the case study. So again, basically, they see firsthand the way in which people are gaming the system and getting welfare checks and all this disability when they actually aren't. She also sees in a very poignant way people that worked in these energy plants where their water was contaminated, polluted, they were exposed, have the help. If you look at the highest number of cancers in these communities, they're the ones that are the strongest Tea Party anti-federal government. And it's this fascinating puzzle that why do they stay loyal to the local corporate interests that they will take care
yeah,
of
that's
them
the key
protect.
Question.
And who,
what's the matter with cancer?
Well,
and who
right.
are the people that she identifies and becomes friends? There
yeah.
are some people
right.
who are actually working against it from inside
yeah.
that community,
yeah.
not
yeah.
outside advocates. And
yeah.
like that one guy, when he's at this, where did all this stuff come from? No, we got these regulations. We check this every night. And he
yeah.
basically says, bullshit.
Yeah.
I was the guy that took the tub
right.
and went
dumped it
every
in the
night.
Every night into the stream.
And
yeah.
blew
and
the
could,
whole thing
yeah.
open.
Right. So it's a wonderful account. But again, it's trying to get at, there are very different parts of this country, trying to get at the different forces at play. So
that's a good illustration of
yes.
this title.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. Well, I think it's fascinating, too, because I contrast that with, and I was digging into, I wanted to start kind of locally, because Holden has a very interesting, complicated relationship with, you know, a major multinational, and how Holden has been able to navigate this in terms of, you know, inheriting this place, the relationship as a community with the remediation, with issues of exposure, with ongoing, and what is our responsibility here locally. I just was looking up, not that Rio Tinto was responsible for the initial contamination, that was when it was owned by a different mining company, yet currently in this day, Rio Tinto is in Madagascar and any of number of these places is being accused of environmental
disgusting.
Contamination.
Oh,
and I just found in Forbes, like, you know, they're profiting right now. Ore prices have gone a new peak because of the instability. There was a terrible explosion of a mine in Brazil that disrupted the amount of ore needed to build steel. So it's a fascinating question with these complicated economic forces as it plays out. But
so does this book, I mean, at least Thomas Frank talks about how values issues or whatever you want to call it, abortion, premarital,
so that's
other
right.
things. I mean,
yes, that's the key piece that we're not,
you know, I think probably increasingly guns rights.
Yeah.
And but Chris
and it's a very religious
and it's like how do you how do you remove the scales from people's eyes without attacking them for being stupid, right?
So the first piece I would, as an educator, is get educated. And this is, again, sort of going, and rather than, you know, it's sort of this us, them, and, you know, sort of reaching out. And so this is one of the interesting struggles, because on the one hand, this week, I've been encouraging you, find people who share your values, find groups, you know, strength, ally, work together, network. But what's key and crucial is also going outside of your comfort zone and sort of figuring out in very different circumstances, people with a different type of view, different agendas, a sense of, you know, what are the important differences that we have in terms of what. So I use the example of for protections, regulations for violations of, you know, contamination of waters, regulating water bodies. Like, why is it that people in Louisiana are opposed to the EPA? If you're looking at, you know, these types of things or those types of concerns, well, you see firsthand that there are other things going on. And as you suggested, the values, the issues of religion and abortion and different sources of authority kind of take precedence over these other issues that...
And sources of information. Yeah.
Right.
But Hochschild, she just kept going back to the fact that no matter how much the corporation harmed these people, destroyed the waters
and fired
all the fish that they lived on, in spite of all that, it was the corporations that paid their way.
Yeah.
That was the only way they had to live.
It was kind of fatalism, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, well, there's a wonderful attachment to the land and their community, and that's what's beautiful and poignant about it, because there's such a beautiful sense of place and beauty and pride in that region that's very distinct. And so it's not that they don't care, you know, and that's what's fascinating.
But the fatalism was of the family that she used as a major illustration.
Yeah.
They were very aware that the corporation... Nobody provided any money for them to move or leave.
Yeah.
There
yeah.
was no way for them to leave.
Yeah.
So I would park it in as a minuscule part of what you said. Know who, what you're up against. Know the...
Well, I live with these people. I have a real it's very hard to dialogue with them. It's a terrible challenge, and especially if they show up with AR-15s and that going back to what we've said, you know, alternative futures, is this a potentially productive turning point this coming election? Possibly, yes. And we sketched the sort of hopeful scenario. The other side is, and this happens more often in history, is that things kind of degenerate into authoritarianism and fascism.
Yeah.
And when you think about it, America is very, very primed for that. I mean, we have an arm, we have 300 million guns out there, and probably about 50 million of them are combat rifles. And, you know, the people who spend their spare time running around the forest practicing for, you know, the coming insurrection when they're going to fight off the federal government that's coming for their rights and for their guns. The level of paranoia, I mean, it is stupidity. If you're looking for one word to describe it all, it is stupidity. It's a lack of education. It's a lack of opportunity. It's a lack of access to good information. But it's pretty scary, especially where I live in the South. I mean, you have a whole environment of people who just are living on another planet.
Yeah.
I mean, they just
Well, there's a question. So this is, again, there's sort of two ways of analyzing this. You can look at what are called empires in decline, and that's a very dangerous time because that's where you see a lot of these things. But then the other interesting thing is the analysts now with all this data mining, these guys at MIT have done all this stuff boring and deep into who is the Republican Party. And they came up a few years ago with just basic demographics, growth, changing types of families, that the Republican Party is in its last gasp and will be gone in 10 years. And this was... 3 years before Trump, but basically it's going to get worse. And so if you look historically at sort of decline of parties, it's not just the whole government that you're seeing this, that it gets more extreme, that you're going to have a big mess. But again, if you're looking, it's historically that just the basic numbers there, it's not going to sustain itself unless you have, you know, so, and this is the question. So you have these, we don't know, you know, it's very important for us to do, you know, kind of informed prognosticating, but
that seems to suggest then that we are in one of those classic realignment periods and so the question, what will be the political force that is the successor force on the right? If one of the parties is going to disintegrate, what is the replacement party?
see my little A Changing World.
Third party. Is it now time for us to start a progressive third party?
Because that may be the one that becomes the other party.
Right.
Because the Democrats have shown through recent history anyway that they're more than willing to face it, they're already a right of center party. So
This is the question. We have a changing world. There are these continuities in change. One of the fundamental things, and you suggested this, is this rise of big money. And with globalization, these forces of money, it's extraordinary. This movement of capital, its impacts, and its significance. And for me, I was really grateful because for me, what's the key story that's happening right now is this just shocking rise of income inequality. And we're aware of it in terms of regional differences growing within states, but it's even more dramatic outside of the United States. But I just want to kind of highlight, and you know, you understand this, but this is a key piece of the puzzle in terms of democracy. And if you look at the historical example, there was this assumption of, you know, sort of the American creed that, you know, hard work, play by the rules, education, all these things, that you would be able to be better off. And yet what you see is this shocking gap in terms of, and I hope you can look at this, this is share of the national income going to the top 0.1%. And this is relatively recent. It's dramatic. And it has a very profound impact in terms of, as we're trying to understand and assess what we have looked at, realignments, what are the trends and forces. You know, we had another, previously, a Gilded Age. We've had these other times where you've had enormous inequities. Yet,
can we get the scale on the bottom?
Sorry. I have it. I will give it to you. I have it on my... I didn't print out my
page. That's like every 50 years,
yeah.
I'm guessing.
Just slide it there on the
why
side.
Why don't you have China in there?
This is just within the U.S. I have my global... you're right. Sorry about that. Yeah. Oh, God. I don't know. You know what? That was just, I cut and pasted the wrong thing. That was from, I did a screenshot. I'm sorry. I have it at home. Well, in my room. I'll give it to you. But so it's like up through 2008 for totally. That this is actually, because this is pre-crash, so it was up to 2008. So the question is, and so for me, over the last 2 years, I have been increasingly researching and looking into this. In terms of these gaps, because these inequities are so extreme. The UN in Geneva did this whole research thing that I went to last fall as I was trying to figure out what should be done. It's not just here domestically, it's also outside of the US. And there was, I liked the name of this conference, it was Overcoming Inequalities in a Fractured World Between Elite Power and Social Mobilization. So I'm trying to figure out what are these forces, because on the one hand, you know, you have that 0.1%, you have the billionaire class, but then there's also this whole issue of kind of elites and elite power. And you see this in Europe with the sense of, you know, with Brexit, that you have these key officials, these elites that are deciding things outside of sort of the interests or agendas of average citizens or people from different backgrounds in Europe. And this is even more striking in other countries around the world. So I just want to, we can go back to what you would like to talk to about, yes. But
so
I feel this at a local level, as well as, I don't want to just...
Who do they include in the elite beyond the wealthiest?
Right. So this was what is extraordinary, because they brought together 50 different research scholars, and so looking in different countries in Latin America, and different regional groups and indigenous groups all around the world. It's very different. Again, within our country, we're preoccupied with these elites and income inequality. I'm assuming that so it is so dramatic in certain cosmopolitan areas on the coasts and cities and certain areas where Christopher lives, his city, Charlottesville, that county is one of the, has more millionaires. What's the name of your county? Yeah, I didn't know this, but it's one of the wealthiest. It has these enormous farmed landed...
Yeah, they only live there on the weekends. The rest of the time they're on Wall Street.
So this is, again, his city was affected, and like, who are the actors? You have the city, people in the, you know, in terms of representation, people of Charlottesville, they had a vote, they decided to remove statues, they had took these actions, but in the wider county, there was pushback, legal forces, and then at the level of the state government, you know, the governor came in. So it's a very interesting issue of how these different forces are coming to play. So you can look at it in local communities. It's even more dramatic if you're looking at the rise of income inequality in different countries and regions. So I can go in more detail about that. But what I was hoping to identify, again, the theme today is each of us has come here trying to, in some way, jumpstart your own lifelong interests and concern with positive social change, how to live a life of commitment, how to have it succeed. And I just wanted to kind of talk about this because we're now confronting another issue that we're trying to figure out how to make sense of it. So for me, as I struggle with, you know, I don't want to feel so burnt out, depressed, what are the policy levers? How can we address this? And in fact, there are any number of ways. And this is what the Howard Zim, and as you look at it, people tackle these problems locally from different special professions and different avenues. But one of the things that I think is important as we think about income inequality is there are any number of ways that we can make positive steps and have an impact. Now, unfortunately, Trump, you know, with this tax law, that went one way. But, you know, how we engage in taxing, local, federal, state level, this is fundamentally important in trying to understand how is this income inequality, the redistribution of wealth, happening. Regulations, entitlements, investments in public goods, and in education. So these are different levers. Anyone want to think of others?
You lost your screen.
I'm talking too much. You guys should talk. All right. So, maybe I timed out.
It's coming back.
Okay, good. All right. But anyway, so there are any number of these policy arenas. So again, as I try to think about this and kind of how do I reframe, how do I look for opportunities, how do I understand these obstacles and challenges, I find it helpful to kind of dig deep. But again, I'm hoping that each of us will kind of go back to your core values. But if you're really thinking about this, there are any number of policy arenas that this can be tackled as we try to think about our current situation. So again, I'm making a profound assumption, and I am biased because I am judging that this enormous disparity of income inequality is not a good, a public good. I see this as something of concern. But in light of that, I think it's really interesting because you see any host of ways in which you can kind of think about it and make positive change, challenge it, engage in these issues from, you know, just property taxes, subsidized housing, all these different areas. State programs, we talk about this with healthcare, we talked about this already with Medicare, Medicaid. You see this being played out in different states. Issues at the federal level, tax code, congressional spending, the courts. So there are a lot of different avenues in which you can engage and where things are happening and affecting policy. So I just wanted to throw this out in terms of just trying to kind of, as we're thinking about, and I really want to spend a few minutes having each of you share, but I also want to end with my wonderful heroine, Shiro Frances Crowe, as we think about this, as somebody who has shown resilience and has adapted and kept going over 100 years of activism. But does anyone want to address in terms of thinking about this?
One thing I want to throw out there, and we've touched on this, and actually, you know, one of your titles is Expanding the Possibility.
Right.
So when we talk about income inequality and the redistribution of wealth toward the top, yes, these are all practical ways. But, you know, there's a moral argument,
right.
There's a values argument, and then you have to shift the discussion in a way so that things that seem radical over time no longer seem
right.
radical. So,
yes.
You know, I know Elizabeth Warren and others of the Nurses Association or Nurses Union has been pushing for a number of years a variation of a speculation tax, a transaction tax on Wall Street,
mm-hmm.
whatever you want to call it,
right.
whatever the language turns out to be that grabs people's attention. I mean, that's essentially generating money on speculation and robotic trading and all this kind of stuff
right.
that doesn't hurt anybody. But then you've got, like, I can't think of his first name, but the candidate Yang, who's talking mm-hmm. about guaranteed income,
right.
which is a real challenge for the future of this country,
right.
and ties in with one of the few successes we've had, yeah. which is this recognition that people at the bottom need more money.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't address the whole picture, but if you begin to throw out proposals such as that,
yeah,
it begins to make some of the other policy proposals that would fit into these categories
right.
seem more palatable, and therefore, in theory,
yeah.
more achievable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, the drop of water in the pool,
oh, I'm so glad. I wanted to put it back in today. I didn't want to overdo it.
Well, I mean, at one level, I think, oh, am I just soothing my conscience for not being as activist as you are with specific policies going into whatever. On the other hand, I look at this problem stream, and you had the three up there leading. Then maybe what we can do is I've read these books, I've read a whole bunch of them, trying to understand, number one, take a look at what I don't know, the naivete, holy cow, what was the American story? How did I end up not knowing this?
You were taught.
How did I not
know this?
You were,
yeah.
you were taught things that were not true.
Yeah. Right. Lies my teacher told me, you know,
yeah.
I read a book and holy crap, you know. Or indigenous people's history of the United States. You know, just, wow.
You didn't teach me. That's
a whole bunch of stuff like that that are done right there. So then, in my specifically Christian arena, I work on how people understand human beings. Mm-hmm. So what I find myself in many conversations where there's just an assumption or a consensus, and I register, no, maybe today is not the... coffee after a workout is not the place to argue this, but I want to register my dissent from the consensus I hear here. Just registered dissent, then I think that another chance is, I don't care what the policy is, as a Christian you can't talk that way about another human being. You simply can't, unless you want to throw out your Bible. If I get in the real biblicistic ones, I'll say, well, then I got it, and then I got really got help. Chart on all the widow and orphan stuff. Oh, crap, there's all that in my Bible.
Yeah.
You know, the selective reading of the Bible.
Yeah.
So you blow it open a little farther. Now, that's chipping away, but I kind of think of that as preparing the soil a little bit.
Sure.
Some
and it's absolutely going with your core values and strength. Yeah.
And try to throw a little drip in to change the mood in which you start to do your policy specifics. A skill I'm not going to get at 73.
Well, you clearly figured out ways of starting that anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, you had your list of the conventional policy options.
Yeah.
But I think we're up against something that's not really going to yield to those kinds of solutions.
So this is within the kind of mainstream. Absolutely. So, yes.
But I mean, I think we're in a qualitatively new situation in the sense that the reason income inequality is where it is and getting worse is because the capital component of work in virtually every area has increased and the labor component has decreased.
Right.
Right? So the return, people who own the capital, directly or indirectly, their returns are going up. People who get their income from labor, their returns are going down, and this is a sort of an inexorable trend that's just going to be compounded by automation. But even if you're in the service sector, you know, you have a lot of poorly paid service workers, except for people who have a patentable piece of knowledge, like a piece of software.
Mm-hmm.
They make revenue again and again and again from that one little piece.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how Microsoft became as wealthy as it did. It's just, it invented some pretty reasonably bad software 40 years ago, and it was off to the races, combined with its monopoly power. And so, those are things that we just have to, that they're going to take, solutions that are beyond what we normally think of as policy, I mean, someone says when you look at these trends, you say socialism is inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
If some huge fraction of the population isn't going to starve or just be on the streets without a job, I mean, you've got to structure society differently ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
take them on. What do you think?
Well. Yes, I'm concerned about the inequality.
Mm-hmm.
But I also am concerned about the fact that that's what we're focusing on. Mm-hmm. And it's a different picture globally. Mm-hmm. And so much has happened globally, mm-hmm. in China, in India, mm-hmm. that is positive. Mm-hmm. Major changes are happening. And what was it Thomas Friedman wrote just a couple of weeks ago? He said, the big mistake is that we have a leader who is trying to go alone,
right.
for maintaining this, it will maintain this income inequality and our way of life that we hold so sacredly. Mm-hmm. If we don't work globally, mm-hmm. and cooperate globally with other leaders to work with China, mm-hmm. on the trade issue, mm-hmm. this is all going to be for naught, mm-hmm. in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you have the same, you can draw the same inequality curves in China or India. Well,
it's dramatic. I mean, it's a global
phenomenon now.
But also, very importantly, though, in terms of the rise of the middle class in these countries, and in terms of people coming out of poverty. So this is just for 10 minutes. So, yeah.
Right. No.
The Indians and the Chinese are not starving anymore.
Right. Well, so this is what, short term, this is what's sort of interesting. So I'm just throwing out to you, because on the one hand, I'm just throwing out on the policy agenda, and I wanted to kind of move on. We have had these moments when we've had momentous changes in terms of, from the Voting Rights Act, Title IX, I think, importantly, people are not paying enough attention to the impact of the Patriot Act on our country, the Affordable Care Act, FISA on out. We have very important, as we were talking about, policy streams, institutions in our government, Congress, Supreme Court, President, Constitution, all of these. And also, as I'm hoping, as we've discussed these things, these cultural dimensions, these assumptions, you mentioned deterrence. I was very pleased you had that. I had that in this. When I teach, there is this idea of American exceptionalism. We sort of got into that a little bit as we were talking about individualism. These ideas of freedom of the press, how they play out in any number of these contested arenas right now, with ICE, with the issue of NATO, with NAFTA, all these different issues. So it's very complicated as we try to understand, as you're struggling with positive social change, and any number of them, you don't know how it's going to play out. But my hope is, as we are sort of trying to get insight, and again, this is, trying to develop a sense of resilience, helping to adapt to these obstacles, helping to recognize when to kind of let go. And in the life of this woman, Frances Crowe, over 100 years, again and again, she came up against tremendous odds. But my goal, what did I do? Oh, it's to sleep again. No, it doesn't. It says, we should be done.
There you go.
Okay. Well, here's Frances Crowe. So one of the interesting things is she just turned 100 this spring. But over and over again, she came of age, had worked during World War II with a military contractor, recognized what she saw was a concern of militarism. She fought any number of issues you see in this profile. What's remarkable is, as you were suggesting, when you got to this period in the 70s on out, early 80s, she came up against a wall. And she felt like working in the peace movement, working against wars, working against nuclear weapons programs, that she wasn't really, it wasn't getting reflected in the media. And she found this one woman and a news service that was called Democracy Now! And it was this little pipsqueak thing. And she then went to, she lives in Northampton, she went to our local public radio station. She said, I think you should have it. It's 1 hour a day. Why don't you have this program? And they demurred. They said, no, we have other programming. We aren't going to air it. So she didn't give up. She set up a radio tower in her yard and started broadcasting it in our valley. And she started yakking, and I mean, I can't even tell you. She is somebody who, if you're coming at these problems in other ways, they're very global, they're enormous, but she really started at home. She was working, she felt like we needed to be educated and engaged. And she was tireless. Every time we would go places, she was like, have you heard of this? Have you listened to it? Engaging in conversation within the community. Over a period of decades, she was able to put that type of pressure, leverage, and, you know, people listened. They were hearing different points of view that they didn't hear in with media consolidation. And ultimately, now it is something that is broadcast on stations. That's just one way in which she's had her odyssey. She just, after 100... Have you heard of Caring Bridge?
Oh, yes.
So I got, while I was here, a message from Caring Bridge about Frances, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, something's happened to her. And it was, she's setting up a network now where she had published an article in our local newspaper. She's concerned about the modernization of Trident missiles, and she's writing this op-ed, and she's using her Caring Bridge with everyone in her community to give us her latest op-ed to get out the word. So I can tell you there are people in my life that, again, I just look at in awe as they've been able to persevere, as they've been able to engage. She is a lifelong Quaker, and she's also the most feisty, tireless, wonderfully inspiring person I can imagine. But I just wanted to use her as an example because I think as we, as we think about these issues, I feel that I am looking around for role models and for ways of trying to kind of sustain and to make peace with the fact you have to go with your strengths. You also have to give yourself a wonderful break, like here at Holden Village, to recharge your batteries, to be taken care of, and so that ultimately you can really be engaged. And we clearly need more analysis. We need more information. We need to kind of really figure out what is going on right now. We cannot just ignore and stand idly by. And it is a question of judgment and action. And kind of going back to this, one person can make a difference and everyone should try. I find that inspiring. And as long as you're with people that are so wonderful, joyful, and engaging, I see, you know, what's the downside? So anyway, I am thinking we have 5 more minutes. And I have, we can either go back and talk about, I'm curious of having done this, like, as any people that you think of that are role models, because this is really why I am doing this, of people that you see that have been able to sustain a life of commitment, activists, that Sisyphean struggle, and yet kind of provide wonderful inspiration for yourselves in your lives. If anyone can think of that and share.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's not a person, it's an organization.
Oh, yeah.
Our city's called Say Tool. It's centrally. Workers united in struggle, essentially.
Excellent.
And, I mean, these are, many of them are undocumented immigrants, and for the last 15 years or so, they have been fighting for workers' rights for undocumented and low-wage workers.
Wait, spell it. It's called, what's
Say Tool.
Okay. S A.
No, C-T-U-L.
Okay, great. I realize, I apologize. This was going to be my whole focus at the end of, like, this is what we did last week, and I'm not trying to distract you, but these were some of the groups that people found inspiring, so I'm so pleased that you reminded me of this.
Even though some of their activists have been deported, they keep going on. They've got a great network of allies in the faith community and beyond.
Excellent.
And they are a conscience for the metro area, increasingly beyond just worker issues. And they've done very specific things, such as getting stolen wages back for people, as well as have some policy impact at the legislature, and especially taking a key role in the 15 Now campaign.
Yeah, 15 Now. We have in our community that same thing of stolen wages. It's really amazing, the success and the impact on people's lives. Yeah. Thank you. Any other groups?
AFSC, American Friends Service.
Yeah. So you want to tell people about it? What do you find inspiring?
Oh, well, they are actively speaking truth to power. And
American Friends Service Committee, if anyone
can. Leading people through poverty to speak out and to become trained to be leaders and peace activists.
Right. Right. They have their mobilized down in D.C. They have, they organize and train, have lobbying times.
They're always there.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Yeah. Yeah. That's wonderful. Any other groups people think of? in our community, we have a group, it's called Sanctuary in the Streets, and it's really exciting to see how it's been mobilizing of dealing with deportations, different issues, and saying, of course, churches are on the front lines, but we also have to be in our streets and communities to stand up and provide sanctuary. And so it's a way of mobilizing if there are issues that come up. There's a hotline, there's information, there's organizing, collecting resources. And very importantly, they've been going to our state, the government, and this has had an impact in terms of, you know, whether or not different, our particular city was a sanctuary city, but at the state level, protections. I get to write that down. Anyone else have groups? Okay, I won't push this too far, but we have two more minutes. I want to really thank you all. I like this slide. Because for me, I find that, you know, the older I get, the more it's like I sort of have my little plan, my little lateral way of thinking and, you know, sort of way of organizing things. Things turn on their head and it's like, okay, this is a good image. You know, maybe I'll remember this. Maybe I can just kind of go with the punches and try to kind of think about this. You never know. Sources of change, where it leads, and most importantly, our role in it. So anyway, I thank you all for being here, and I'm hoping that we will continue this conversation.